So what's up, everyone? Welcome to another exciting episode of the Curious K podcast. My name is Kolapo and I'm your host. And on today's episode, we're going to have a great conversation. And this episode features Mark Kleiner, the co-founder and program director of Dream VC. And if you're just hearing about Dream VC, Dream VC is a community-driven educational platform that runs highly selective remote programs on venture capital and the innovation ecosystem across Africa. Thank you, Mark, for joining us today on Curious K podcast. It's an honor to have you on the show.
Likewise, thanks for having me on, Kolapo.
All right, and Mark, I'm looking forward to a very exciting conversation. And I know even before this call, we've been having conversation back and forth. So, you know, I can't wait for you to just share all the exciting things about Dream VC and your plan for the investment landscape across Africa. But before we get into all that, Mark, I would like you to just give us a background, you know, your background as an entrepreneur. How did that evolve into you starting Dream VC?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, on my end, I think probably what's first useful to mention is I actually grew up in Eastern Europe. I only moved over to the UK and would come to work in Africa only in the past few years. Now, my background as an entrepreneur really started in a bit of an unconventional way. I don't have a story of being a 12-year-old building some kind of business or a 16-year-old prodigy or anything like that.
Instead, or selling sweets in school.
yes, nothing like this. No orange juice selling stories on my end or anything like that. I think my move into entrepreneurship was a bit more accidental. I began my career actually in consultancy as a management and then a digital consultant working with multinational companies out of the UK and Europe. And it was really just a shift away from consulting and problem solving for other people that prompted me to explore entrepreneurship. I had worked for some time in several consultancies and had left the typical corporate world to build a consultancy of my own, joining a couple of individuals who were equally alumni from my university, University of Edinburgh up in Scotland, to build a digital transformation consulting firm of our own. And I hadn't even thought about it at the time of this being a startup. It was more like a service business. But the very process of building the firm, scaling the firm, and growing it, we grew it from 4 individuals to over 140 over the course of 2 years across our teams.
Wow. That's great.
It really kind of opened my eyes to the fact of the world of startups, the world of growth, the world of scaling businesses and creating wealth where wealth previously didn't exist. So it really made me really excited to jump into the startup space, and I would take that full on. So I would go on to work for a couple of different startups. All of them have since become venture-backed. Let's assume that I contributed partially to that, but really it was just a great selection of teams all around the world. I'd work in Singapore, in the US, out of Eastern Europe, out of the UK, and even to an extent indirectly with some founders who were building very early on in parts of West Africa. But really, the jump from the entrepreneurship into building Dream VC came through the transitory path of becoming a venture builder. I'd been working for a couple of startups in growth and in operations, and then venture capital seemed to always be somewhat out of my reach and somewhat of a sector that I didn't really understand. But I'd always had the idea that it was curious how someone could sit on the investor side and potentially be just working on growing companies again and again and again. I think I found that whole growth process really exhilarating. So I moved into venture building and eventually found myself working for multiple different venture capital funds over the years. And the transition to Africa came when opportunity allowed me to run an impact accelerator. I joined as a co-founder for an impact accelerator focused on very, very early stage African deals. And I got to work with entrepreneurs directly, almost like a plug-in external force, helping them to scale very, very early on. I realized that working with startups is something I really enjoyed, but I also wanted to remain focused on working with investors. And when we recognized the problem statement that gave Dream VC a reason to exist, I jumped on the opportunity to help found something of my own. And that's where I am today. running Dream VC as a co-founder and program director with an entirely African focus.
Absolutely. That's a very, very interesting background right there, Mark. I mean, the transition from like a consultancy, like you mentioned, service business, the impact accelerator program, you know, and the VC side is just, I mean, it's a very interesting trajectory right there. So let's talk about Dream VC, right? What is the focus of Dream VC as an investor accelerator program in Africa?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good place as any for me to give a bit more context about Dream VC. And I think the point where I always start with is, what does it mean when we say we are the investor accelerator for Africa? I think a lot of people are familiar with the concept of startup accelerators, programs that are structured, that support startups to go week to week to build through things like business models, their go-to-markets, their approach of dealing with customers, their pricing, and eventually leading up to fundraising. I'm sure even among the listeners, we have tons of people who are familiar with Y Combinator, Techstars, and all of these. But investor accelerators aren't really a widespread concept. And it's because many people think that incorrectly that, you know, it's really easy to be an investor, whereas realistically, it's just the other side of the coin. It's often just as difficult to be a successful investor as it is to be a successful startup founder. And what we recognized was that investors, especially who want to be focused on African markets, whether they're based there or investing internationally, need a lot more support to actually get started, a lot more support to continue to invest, and a lot more support to scale up. So for us, we focus not on training individuals to become founders, but training individuals to become successful investors, hence the investor accelerator part. And Dream VC is not a fund or a syndicate, as you might imagine from our name. It's really at the core of our name that we helped individuals who are dreamers to make that transition from just dreaming about at some point being involved with the VC space or in the innovation economy to actually realizing that dream. So we help be that bridge, bridging their dream into reality and helping them move into venture capital work or venture capital professions. We do this through remote cohort-based programs, just like other accelerators. And these also run annually and are very exclusive, but they focus on the individuals rather than on companies. We tend to train working professionals from all different walks of life, former business developers, marketing people, founders, operators, current investors who want to upskill. There's a whole spread of individuals from all different parts of the world and different specialties as well. And just since 2021, I'd say we've trained close to 90 fellows spread across about 30 African countries, many of whom have gone on to do really amazing things, launching new angel networks, setting up investment syndicates, joining African funds like Lateral Frontiers or Gym Capital. There's a lot of things. So our focus on training African-focused investors really runs at the core of our work. So if I had to summarize, what do we do? Well, it's really just about that, building the investor ecosystem by training individuals to become the investors we want to see investing in African startups.
That that's really interesting, you know, and I actually wanted to ask about the concept of the name Dream VC, right? Mm-hmm. But I'm happy you touched about it while you know, talking about like the focus of the investor accelerator mm-hmm. program, because typically, you know, what you hear about is startup accelerator program. Okay, I've been trying an incubator program. Then, okay, I need some funding, then an accelerator program will be ideal for me. But when you hear about the concept of the investor accelerator program, it's new. And that takes me to what needs to change, all right? Because this is new, all right? And I believe there is a pain you're trying to solve here. There is a lot of education that has to be done. You know, there is a lot of high net worth individuals that still don't understand the startup ecosystem. So since you've been running the Dream VC Investor Accelerator Program, so fundamentally, for a successful startup program to thrive across Africa, what do you think has to change, or what are you changing currently?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think I'll focus really on not just startups and investors as separate, but the entire startup investor ecosystem, if you allow me, to how we can make sure that this thrives across African countries. And I think if I had to describe this, I would break it down into so-called upstream, what really happens at the very, very early stages. So startup building, startup founding, angel investors, and downstream, whether that's the traditional venture capital space, growth equity, international investors, and the private equity world. And if I had to approach it like this, then what's going on upstream? Well, upstream is where the ecosystem is really born. And I speak with this from the experience of having grown up in emerging markets myself, growing up in Eastern Europe, working in Southeast Asia, working in parts of Africa. I've seen this, and I've seen this being repeatedly solved and sometimes incorrectly not solved in different markets. There needs to be direct support for angel investors, aspiring founders, and early stage managers alike. And this can take many different forms for a successful ecosystem to thrive. But I'll explore a couple of examples that really come to mind initially that have always worked. One such example is catalytic funding. What does that mean? Well, this is when governments, local or national or federal, sponsor funding that matches angel investments into startups. I'm not talking about giving funding to investment managers. I'm not talking about governments giving away grants. I'm talking about governments looking at investment managers who are already investing in a startup and saying, okay, this means that these investors believe this is the startup that's going to change the world. Let's match that investment. Because quite often these startups are actually wanting to raise more than they end up raising. And this catalytic funding means that the government can get exposure to the tech ecosystem, can start building those critical relationships with the future Idris Bellows, the future Ian Aluas out there at a very, very early stage, while also giving them funding without the necessary, you know, effort that it takes to run a government-managed fund. You could also be talking about capital gains incentives for individuals. If you're not familiar, the whole concept of capital gains is essentially the tax you're paying once you sell a stake in an asset. You buy a home, the house appreciates in value, you sell it, but you have to pay tax. And the same applies to investments you make in private startups or in businesses. And this is often a disincentive for wealthy individuals to put their money into small business or into startups. If they know that the business is going to grow, but if they ever sell their stake, they're going to lose a lot of that money, essentially for nothing, they see it as, why would I ever want to do this? I don't want to pay extra taxes. Yeah. So, you know, the government can incentivize this by reducing those taxes. And that's what's happened in Singapore, in Hong Kong, in the UK, in the US. Those governments go ahead and say, if you invest in startups in the local ecosystem, we will either entirely waive this portion of tax for you, or we will make it much, much more lucrative. So we won't charge you 50% of your returns, but maybe 5 or 10%. This means a lot more people are investing in these startups, a lot more wealth is created, and hence a lot more startups get to grow at this early stage and succeed to move on to become bigger businesses. Support for founders at this stage can also be present, right? Tax credits, research and development incentives, free or discounted office space. There's a whole bunch of in-kind benefits that can decrease pressure that a typical founder might face. Doesn't matter if you're building out of Yaba or you're a very wealthy founder building, for example, out of a wealthy neighborhood in Abuja, you're still going to face some particular financial pressures early on, and giving them some support of tackling that or these guidance on how to keep costs low can really help to make the startup ecosystem a bit more efficient. It's critical that founders have access to space, to a low-cost environment, high-speed internet, stable electricity, and the ability to tap into the local labor pool. And some markets in the world make this very difficult. For example, in parts of the UAE, it's difficult to hire local labor for particular roles, right? And to build a more efficient ecosystem on the continent, it's important that none of those restrictions are in place. It's actually deregulated and easier for individuals to start a business. So you can already see that there's a lot that we can be doing at the very early stages. And the story just continues once you look later on, so-called downstream in the VC, you know, growth equity, private equity, wealth management world. At the moment, they're actually quite punitive restrictions that prevent cross-border ownership. You might want to invest in a Moroccan business and you might not be able to own more than 50% of that business. Or a Moroccan might want to invest in a Nigerian business and often they'll face the same story. So even if they want to provide funding, sometimes they can't because of restrictions that were built 50, 40 years ago. This doesn't reflect the globalized world we have today. So often there's little protection for investors, but punishment when investors want to invest more money into the space. How can we change that? Well, again, it's not impossible. You need to just strengthen the courts, strengthen the judicial system, provide safeguards for investment businesses, and give them incentives to invest, such as a decreased tax burden. These are great steps, and this is what you see the Cayman Islands doing, Bermuda doing, it's no surprise that almost every African fund manager doesn't incorporate their fund on the continent. Why do they go to the UK or the US to incorporate? It's those same judicial protections, the strengths of those courts, and investment incentives. And they can be built and they can be launched. And I think it's quite possible we will see that. But fundamentally, it's that public-private sector collaboration that really, really needs to happen. And if that starts to happen, then we'll see more institutional funding going from maybe later stage African investors to earlier African investors, more public-private sector collaborations, and then a more sufficiently sustainable, scalable startup investor ecosystem across the continent.
Wow. I mean, that's some insight right there, Mark. I mean, talking about this, I was thinking about all these issues and the work which they have to do to grow this ecosystem. And what comes to my mind when we are talking about the tax incentives is the recent startup bill or startup act now that's been passed in Nigeria, and I think it's exiting maybe some other African countries. And I'm just looking forward to the execution of this act. And maybe if some of these items you've talked about can be really addressed, you know, and because this is really fundamental in growing the tech ecosystem and driving, you know, investment. Another key part you mentioned is the limits when it comes to ownership, right? Which is still exists in Nigeria. You know, there are some things you can't even have access to if typically a Nigerian doesn't own like maybe 51% of the company. You know, I mean, except you have to go through some route and so many other things.
Yeah, so it's complicated.
Yeah, it's really, really, really complicated. And I believe the Startup Act, or maybe policies makers, can really think about how we can address these issues, you know, one by one, you know, to position the continent as the ideal place. You know, Africa has been talked about as the last frontier and all that, but there's a lot that has to change fundamentally in terms of our, you know, of our legal framework, protection from investors, tax incentives, and all that. You know, so these high net worth individuals that only see real estate, you know, as a safe haven when it comes to investment, you know, can start to look the other way around, think about startups and the opportunity for growth. We talk about unemployment, right? You know, if these businesses grow, the raise money, they employ people, that will reduce and it will create, you know, a ripple effect going forward. So it's a great point there, Mark. And let's talk about diversity in VC. I mean, you mentioned earlier that on one of your podcasts that I listened to, that the VC industry has been around maybe 60, 70 years. You know, I mean, you have the same, it's kind of closed. So what are your thoughts in terms of like gender diversity in the VC? I mean, funding going to female founders in Africa. And then we can talk about limited investment by African Angel Network. I know that's packed, but we can break it, you know, one after the other. So let's start with the diversity.
I mean, I'm not surprised, Kalapo. I think this follows nicely from our private chats. I know we can go for hours and hours talking about these things. And to be honest, it's good that we get some of these issues out there and we start talking about them more openly. And good to hear you're also doing your due diligence. Clearly, you'd make a nice investor in the making if you ever decided to move into that side, doing your digging and your research before. But yeah, so let's start perhaps with gender diversity in VC. So where should I start with this? I think it's always nice to start with big numbers. So maybe a big number that I'll give to our listeners is 90%. 90% sounds like a good test score. It sounds like a good, almost complete environment. But as it stands, in this case, 90% I'm using positively. As of today, about 90% of VC fund managers, VC partners, and actually running venture capital firms globally are male. Despite that, about 50% of businesses globally are built by women. Something sounds wrong. And if you actually dig deeper into this, even as of, I think, about 2021, if you look at reports by some of the biggest associations that try and track investment into female startups or highlight this issue, such as Women in VC, for example, only about 5% of VC partners in the US are women, even today, even considering all the initiatives that support female fund managers, even considering how more arguably awake the US is about existing gender diversity issues. By our estimates, the numbers are already better in Africa in general. As many as 22% of senior positions in African VC are filled by a woman, by Dream VC's estimate, even though the partner numbers are still much, much worse. But hopefully this will continue to climb. Even in our programs, for example, we've seen a consistent set of very, very high caliber female fellows. And as the statistics actually shows, most of the women who go through our programs are actually much more likely than the guys to carry through and finish the program. Despite that, I'd say overall, somewhere close to about 35-36% of all Dream VC fellows ever to date have been women or female. And in some programs, this is close to 50%. So, you know, there is some kind of trend towards parity, but why do we keep talking about gender diversity in VC as a problem? It's not just because, you know, someone thinks that the world isn't fair or because we talk about this just out of some wokeness or some idea that there's social justice at hand. It's actually very much rooted in illogical decision making. Why do I say that? Because logical decision making means we consider all the potential factors and we invest, we support companies, we build companies, we go and build ideas by the best people to build that idea at the best possible time. But in reality, this doesn't happen. And multiple studies over the years by the IFC, by Harvard Business Review, and by various VC funds actually suggest that one of the biggest reasons why women tend to receive less VC investment than men across the world is the fact that so few women make up decision-making roles in VC. Male investors are just naturally more likely to empathize with male peers and female investors with female peers. And practice suggests that many investors even ask women founders different questions than male counterparts, right? So, I mean, you can imagine this coming in play, especially with more traditional investors, considering how the investor ecosystem tends to be a bit older than the wider economy. Individuals could still see gender roles in the traditional norms of the 1950s and the 1970s might ask, for example, female founders about how they plan to tackle birth, whereas they obviously wouldn't ask the same questions of a guy. And this disparity, even though it might seem trivial, if you imagine this spanning to 1,000 questions, to 1,000 investors, to 1,000 startups, it becomes systemic, right? So it's not just as simple as saying, let's go and train 1,000 new female fund managers and the problem solved, we can dust our hands and everything's equal. Unfortunately, right? I've seen a couple of people around the world, especially bankers, echoing this sentiment, hey, let's just bring more women into the space and then it's all fine. But you have to really dig at that wider structural issue, take a step back and look at it from like almost a bird's eye picture view. The number of women in positions of power within the limited partner world, the world that backs VC funds, that gives money to private capital, to give money to private equity, it's actually also very, very low. So if you want to change the number of women sitting in the VC world, you need to take a step downstream into pension funds, sovereign funds, family offices, the organizations that actually give money to VC funds. And it's only by trending towards gender parity downstream that then upstream the VC world can change. And if it's the VC world that changes, then you can see greater gender equality in investment teams. And finally, greater gender equality in terms of fund distributions, right? So you can see how this is a really big issue that you can't just solve by snapping your fingers, unfortunately. But even beyond that, there are other issues at hand. I think a lot of people say it's just a matter of training more women to move into the market. But I don't think that's, you know, the only issue that we need to talk about. I think it's especially clear for someone who's actually lived, worked, or done business in any African market. Take Uganda as an example. Take Nigeria as an example. Women are much more likely to be entrepreneurs running the small businesses, small shops out there. I'm sure you've seen this as well. But absolutely. They are less likely to be tech entrepreneurs. Why? It's because even today, men make up a much larger pool of the developers, techies, operators, software engineers who are out there who are more likely to naturally gravitate towards being tech founders. So even though more than 50% of small businesses in Africa today are run by women, women founders tend to only raise, you know, somewhere under 15% of all VC funding. And I think this suggests not just that there's a problem with the VC sector in funding the right number of women, but potentially that there needs to be alternative funding instruments that are actually a better fit for these business types. someone building a set of market stalls, for example, in a mass market, could still have a great business, but it's not a tech startup, so it shouldn't be raising VC funding. It should be looking to get debt financing, revenue-based financing, project financing, infrastructure funding. But all of this is overshadowed by the fact that we've seen such success in VC recently. So people turn to VC and say, why isn't VC solving all of these problems? Well, it's not solving all these problems because it's still very nascent. And there needs to be a lot that changes. So VC should change, but we should also start thinking what other financial instruments, what other parts of the financial world need to really grow and balloon on the continent to adequately support founders from all different walks of life. And I think it's only through that that we can actually reach an environment where perhaps 50% of the funded businesses are run by women, not just necessarily in VC.
Interesting. And I mean, looking at this data, it just points out to the work that needs to be done, right? And I like the fact that you're able to even go deeper, you know, even talking about the LPs, for instance, the LPs, you know, fund the VCs, right? So even if you don't change that, because that's fundamental, how are you going to, you know, impact like the VC, the general partners landscape? So yeah. I think that's really deep. And I like the fact that it you're going deep and this is tackling the problem from the root. All right. And like you said, it's not something that you can just say, okay, we train 2-3 and we'll move on. All right. It has to go deeper than just training some VCs that are female and you think you're good. It has to go deeper. So, I mean, the family offices, I mean, women taking more responsibility, you know, in making those decisions. I mean, the pension funds. How many pension funds do we have in Nigeria, Africa, for example? Who are the CEOs running it? Even those with pension funds are not currently giving money to VCs in Africa. But of course,
that's
even
if you have a conversation of its own, right?
a conversation on itself. But even if you're looking at the future, what can potentially happen? I mean, these are like fundamentals that has to to change. Thank you, Mark, for talking about that. So let's talk briefly about limited investments by African Angel Network. All right, Lagos Angel Network has been around for a while. Even while I was building my startup, I think 2014. I think I've actually even pitched to Lagos Angel Network. And I know they've grown to maybe they've even supported setting up some angel network across Africa. But generally, the ecosystem to talk about limited investments coming from this angel network, you know, across board. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I think angel networks is a tricky thing because angel networks should, in theory, and are in theory a really, really critical part of this ecosystem coming together. Because angels on their own right haven't got necessarily an incentive or a medium through which they interact with each other. In a thriving tech ecosystem, a wealthy individual or a high-earning individual can join a community, join an investment club, join a syndicate, get to know others, and get access to great deals where maybe your 10,000 doesn't give you access to that major investment, but pooling your money together with 10 or 100 other people means you're just as interesting to a startup as raising money from a large VC fund. The problem is that angel networks, in my opinion, haven't been consistently built with the same degree of quality across the continent. There are a couple of angel networks that are staffed with very knowledgeable angels that have individuals involved who are actually from the VC world. An example is the former Cairo Angel Syndicate, the Lagos Angel Network, Josie Angels in South Africa, Dazzle Angels out of South Africa as well, as some examples that come to mind, right? And these angel networks have actually been out there investing in deals, periodically engaging in education. I would say the South African Angel Network, for example, are actually some of the most active ones. I've heard of angel networks and angel clubs that have made 30, 40 investments over the last 5 years, which is actually not bad for an angel network. The problem is, what happens outside of these select few examples? As we speak, there are more than 60 angel networks across the continent, but the vast majority of them average maximum one investment a year across the entire collective of angels. And that again suggests that something is wrong. The whole incentive of an angel network is to make sure that people have easier ability to invest, more access to deals, more knowledge, more information, and are therefore more likely to invest more frequently than they were investing as individuals. But what I see is actually the opposite. Quite often when I meet individual angels, they invest much more frequently than when they do this through angel networks on the continent. And I think this might be speaking to the fact that angel networks don't yet have the same power or authority they might have in the UK or in the US. For example, in the US, the US SEC even consults with angel networks on small business acts and policies. I would hardly imagine the same happening with the Lagos Angel Network and government authorities on a federal level, at least just yet. So support, tax incentives, ease of finding opportunities, access to deals, building knowledge about investing, and making membership easy, accessible, but also interesting for members is something that most angel networks haven't done an amazing job of just yet. There have been a select number of great angel networks out there that are indeed really going above and beyond, but I think they're often struggling because of this lack of this public-private market collaboration. You can't organize amazing, you know, infrastructural training programs or push for incentives when your entire angel network is 20 people and the government doesn't look at tech or startups as a major industry. So I can imagine angel networks getting more powerful and hopefully more influential over time, but the aspect of them driving investments, I don't really see that being the biggest driver, at least in the next 5 years, because I still think they're not strong enough to overcome that trust factor. Are you going to just invest with 10 people you just met? Are you really going to put your personal money together into a deal that you don't really know about? I think those trust barriers that currently exist across most of the continent are going to take a much longer time to overcome. And that's why I think it's really important that not just through GMVC, but more widely, that individuals who are interested in investing, who are interested in innovation, who are interested in VC, always upskill themselves, even individually, because then it raises the bar for everybody else. It puts pressure on people to think, okay, I should know what I'm doing at this point. I'm not just coming to this angel network and expecting them to give me everything on a golden platter, because unfortunately, they just aren't able to do that at this point.
Yeah, that's right. And while talking about that, I mean, something came to my mind, which is the model, like some VC explore, you know, in trying to raise fund in maybe some part of Africa. And I don't know if this is happening in the US or Europe, but basically the model is you have to pay to have access to deal pipeline. For example, maybe you pay $1,000 a year or $2,000 a year. And the promise is that you have access to pipeline of deals. And once you have access to those pipeline of deals, you can make a minimum investment into those deals. Can't Angel use similar models, or is that like the existing model? Or can't some of them scale? You know, I'm just thinking around that model and how that can play into Angel networks, right? Because Angel networks do kind of pay deals, you know, I think so too. There is operations network, secretariat network to make it run. Mm-hmm. So, or is it just that when it comes to the deal making or the pipeline, people don't come out to, you know, invest or in the deals?
Yeah, I mean, I think you really hit the nail on the head in terms of the business model. So what you're describing is often the business model for syndicates. So when funds say, hey, we want to open up our investment activity to others around us to maybe get high net worths or high earning individuals in the space investing together with us, you can take loads of African examples, Hoke, Rallycap, Future Africa, Sufficient Capital, Jeddah Syndicate. There's a bunch of them out there. Most of them, they say, pay us a very small fee, something like, you know, hundreds or sometimes a thousand or two USD per year. And then essentially you're paying to get VC level deals without doing any research or due diligence or accounting on your own. In theory, that makes sense. And the reason that they do that is essentially this goes partially to cover the costs of setting up the legal instruments necessary for that investment. The problem is that people pay to be members of these communities, to be members of these collectives, but actually very few people then go ahead and put their money where their mouth is and invest. And if you think about it like that, then you're just wasting your own money. It's no different from signing up for a very expensive gym membership and then never going. And, you know, I always find it very strange because for me, you know, I've definitely been guilty of this as well with gym memberships and, you know, other like service memberships. You sign up to something and you forget about it. But when you do this for thousands of dollars, I think I would feel very self-conscious if I was signing up to something and I knew I wasn't going to put my money to work. But we've spoken with so many of these African syndicates. I'd say definitely more than three quarters of them have some touch point with DreamVC. And most of them, if you actually look at the members, you have hundreds of people who pay membership fees and then a dozen who invest. So what's going on? Why are people paying for membership if they don't actually use that membership? Is it just a status symbol? Is it to put it on the wall and say, ah, I'm a member of all of these groups, but then you don't actually want to risk your own money? Maybe that's the case. I don't have as much visibility to comment on that. But I think what really needs to change is that step between when you already have knowledge of a deal, when you look at a startup, and then when you actually put your money into that startup. That last step actually is a huge hurdle to overcome. And I think most angel networks don't recognize and don't realize that this is the biggest barrier. They think the biggest barrier is membership. They think the biggest barrier is awareness of angel investing. It's not. I think it's really thinking, how can we activate these investors and their money? And I often say, we want to help you do that, right? So whether that means coming in and teaching people, you know, that angel investing is not just an American thing, it's not just the European thing, it's actually quite simple and something that you can learn and you can pick up, whether it's teaching people that it's okay to fail because you learn through your failures, and investing in a failed business often means that you'll learn much more, much quicker than you will investing in just one or two successful case studies. Whether it's exploring the fact that liquidity is not quite the same, there's no quarterly MTN dividend that's going to come from that one-stop mom and pop shop selling yam on the corner, right? Backing them is certainly not going to give you anywhere close to returns you might get backing equities in oil and gas, but you could get some phenomenal returns if you really find the next big thing. And I think that's really what gets people really excited about the industry. As an angel investor, you invest the earliest. So you have potentially the biggest increase in terms of how much of a percentage return you can get on your investment.
Absolutely. And another thing, maybe I'm thinking in terms of a business model that can be explored, because you mentioned earlier about project financing, when you were talking about mom and pop shop, and that women wouldn't gravitate into tech businesses generally, but some of them have big businesses that maybe equity financing might not necessarily be the best model. It might be merchandise financing, you know, for some of this business, and there'll be some agreed revenue share over it. I think maybe these are some of these models that can be explored by maybe some of these angels, because some people are still not really sure of putting their money somewhere and no expected return in the next 6-7 years. You know, they're like, what is happening? You know, but when maybe when you propose a deal of some mature businesses that you know, okay, this business is doing X revenue, you know, and if you finance it, then there is a potential of getting to this revenue, then you can get your return back. You know, maybe that is what Africa really needs, or maybe that's what most investors in Africa really understand. And if models can be built around that, I think it can help the ecosystem grow. You know, that's just a thought in terms of what I think can be done personally. So let us move into breaking into VC. We've talked about the gender inequality in the space. Apart from that, I mean, you still have a very small number of people in the VC world generally across the world, and it's getting harder for people to even break into it, and that is part of what you're doing with Dream VC. So can you tell us about that in terms of how you're helping people to break into the VC? Can you tell us about that program?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I'd love to. And I think you're absolutely right. I think for those of us who may be among the listeners who just are interested in tech and haven't really heard about VC before, What you really need to understand is that technology seems like a small sector as part of the global economy. But if technology is small, then VC is actually infinitesimal. It is so small that you wouldn't even see it if all the different industries were mapped. Around the entire world today, there are only several tens of thousands of VC firms, all the world combined, which means that there's a very limited number of roles out there. And even though there will always be new VC firms launching, a VC firm doesn't go out and hire 100 members of staff or 1,000 like a factory or a medium-sized enterprise. Even multi-million, sometimes multi-billion dollar funds might have a teams of 10 to 20 people. What that means is it's very difficult to break into the market of actually being a startup investor institutionally. And for me and my co-founder, we launched Dream VC on the back of having worked in several VC funds in the US, in Europe, in Asia, and in Africa. And we'd really seen how difficult it is to break into the venture capital world without a traditional background, even in well-capitalized markets. Someone without a private equity background or an investment banking background, for example, still finds it a bit harder to move into venture capital, even in Europe or the US, where there are many, many different funds who've existed for 50, 60 years. In the African context, there's only a handful of funds that have existed for more than 10 years. Most funds are very, very young and very nascent and very early. This means that they struggle often to build a brand for themselves and attract people. And at the same time, there aren't a lot of individuals in the labor market today who understand and have the skill sets that are necessary for these VC funds to succeed. Immediately prior to running Dream VC, I had been running an impact accelerator, MGZ Africa, with my current co-founder, Cindy, where we ran consulting, advisory, and these growth sprint programs for very, very early stage pre-seed startups. And in the process of doing this, we realized something that was a bit of a weird experience for us. By this point, I'd worked with accelerators and funds and venture studios and multiple venture-backed companies. And I thought, you know, VC would be somewhat similar around the world. But when we were building this accelerator, as usual, we tapped into local experts and startup mentors and advisors and loads of goodwill from individuals in the startup space. But we realized that for every group of about 100 people who are out there tweeting about it, saying how much they love startups, how much they support startups on LinkedIn, about 97 to 98 have never, ever put a single dollar of their own money into investing in deals. So people are talking a lot, but they're not often actioning that. They're not going to build startups in their own end. They're not going to invest in startups. And we would run training for our own venture building teams who would work with these startups, but the training got so popular that our advisors and mentors who were supposed to help us would come to our own training. And they'd say, oh, we wanted to also listen in on this. And we were constantly getting requests from friends, from peers, from individuals in Nigeria and Kenya and Ghana and Uganda, asking us, how can we break into VC? How can we be like you guys? How can we work for African fund or US fund or European fund? So we thought, well, clearly it seems like there's a problem here. And it was clear to us also why this problem wasn't being solved. I mentioned earlier how VC teams are very lean, somewhat like a startup. They're very, very small. So there's no HR department or training department or recruitment department. Historically, venture capital and private equity has always been a career that's more of a postgraduate career for individuals who have a couple of years of experience in the market. So the assumption is everybody who goes and joins a VC fund already knows what they're doing. They don't need to get trained. They don't really need to get onboarded. But you can imagine what a nightmare this becomes if you have new funds that need a lot of people that are looking at the same few limited individuals in the market, and those individuals don't have the experience that they need. So you see a scenario where a US fund that has a lot of money might spend $20 to put out ads to hire a good candidate, but an African fund that has 10 times less money to manage is spending $6,000, $10,000, $20,000 to bring in someone from China, from the UK, or from the US to join that team. It's a ridiculous environment. So we wanted to change that. And we really set out to do that initially just on the basis of helping our friends and peers so that their learning process would be a bit more structured. I couldn't keep taking out time almost every day of the week to teach our friends. So we decided it would be better to structure a program that really took people from zero to 100 without the missing gaps or the missing pieces. And very soon it became very clear that this was such a big infrastructural gap, this investor knowledge, investor networks, investor capital that we made this our full-time focus. And now our mission is very much to build out the investor support and knowledge infrastructure for Africa, both horizontally and vertically across the ecosystem. So we do this by providing the knowledge they need, providing the guidance they need, giving them tailored coaching and built-in networks to get a more driven and collaborative individuals to join the angel and venture capital ecosystem across Africa. An example you may have seen is, as we often say, we aren't just trying to accelerate more check writers. We're trying to really catalyze another and a newer and a larger generation of African ecosystem builders.
That's really important in terms of like the opportunity and the gap. I was talking with Ajim Capital, I think it was on the podcast last year. And before starting our fund, I mean, she was talking about how the VC industry is opaque. I mean, it's just hard for you to understand what is going on, you know? So I believe the platform like Dream VC and what you're doing, it's really going to be transformational, you know, in helping this industry grow across Africa. So let's talk about like the decline of global venture funding. There was a decline last year globally, I think up to 35% decline in VC funding. Even though in Africa, based on the data you're looking at, I think we discussed about this before the podcast too. I mean, like we're almost at the same numbers, right? Or maybe you want to share something else different. And there's been layoffs across global tech companies, laying off, you know, decline in VC funding. So based on some of these data points, right, what are the opportunities for is it going to have for African startups? Do you think African startups will still be able to raise more money? Do you even think the funds will be able to raise more funds, you know, to support startups locally? It would be great to hear your thoughts on that.
I think I had somewhere like five questions in there, so let me try and go through them one by one. I think, Kalef, you're really putting me on the spot here for a Friday, but all right, let me try and get through this. I mean, I think first things first is I actually love the fact that you used Ajim Capital as an example for talking about the difficulties of raising funds in Africa, because Ajim is a great case study of what's possible through what we do at Dream VC. As of today, everyone in Ajim Capital, like but one employee, has come from Dream VC. The entire investment team, practically the platform team, even Eunice herself has been regularly in touch with us, and we've been helping her with solving particular challenges. So I think it's really a case of giving individuals who want to build something access to the right network. And we've had a bunch of fellows who've come to us and gone on to VC analyst roles, associate roles, head of venture roles. So it's really awesome that it's possible to get those outcomes, you know, as a result of what we do. And I say this because this is one of the things that's going to channel into your question around whether we will see a decline in VC funding in Africa. Now, you've talked about a couple of things globally, so perhaps I'll address that first. Yes, globally, the second half of 2022 has some scary signals. Firstly, companies publicly and privately at the very large stages, you know, when we're talking about Series D firms, $100 million giant tech firms out there, many of them are overvalued. What that means is most individuals in the public markets were thinking that these companies were valued more or could generate a lot more revenue than what they could realistically generate. And as we speak, the US, parts of Europe, the UK, and many other parts of the world are already in a short or potentially small financial recession. Global recessions are never a good sign. Usually it means it becomes more difficult to access financing. Banks start to make it more difficult for you to get funding for particular projects. Mortgages and loans become more and more unaffordable, and more people have an incentive to save rather than spend, which means that startups who are reliant on this spending often struggle to grow. But it's not an all doom and gloom situation. Despite what people might think, it's actually not quite the same as the 2008 financial crisis or even the 2000s dot-com boom that would result in a crash when investors realized that startups were somewhat overvalued. As we speak today, yes, VC funding has fallen in Latin America, in the US, in Europe, in terms of investments in the same quarterly period, but it's not gone away. And that's the critical thing. In fact, VC firms and private equity firms, as we speak today, have more money than they've ever had before in their lives, in the entire history of humanity. What this means is that there's a lot of money that's already in the hands of people who have a moral, ethical, and contractual obligation to invest that money. What's different is now many of them are much more worried about investing that money. So they might have even more money than they had last year or the year before, but they're now under a lot of pressure from their own investors, from pension funds or governments who are saying, over these last few years, some of you have made great investments, but others have made terrible investments. You've backed the FTXs out there who've turned out to be scams. You've backed crypto companies who've collapsed. You've backed startups who promised us amazing growth, but they haven't grown in some cases. So how can we trust the VC sector again? And usually this always happens after a period when the global economy has been growing and everything seems rosy year on year and year on year. And then there's a bit of a step back, you know, two steps forward, one step back kind of thing. And I'm really sure that 2023, that's us taking that step back, because several government funds, several pension funds, several hedge funds who are excitedly looking at this rapid growth of startups around the world are now thinking, oh my gosh, we don't actually know what we're doing in the startup space. That's not what we're set out to do. We're going to take a step back and maybe not invest as much in startups. And what this in theory means is the total amount of funding that's available to go towards startups is falling. But remember, that funding that existed that's in the hands of investment funds is still in those hands. So as long as funds haven't already deployed all of their funding, they should be in a good position to invest. So for founders who are really building great ventures out there, I would still say it's very, very possible that they can fundraise just as much, if not even more, than they raised before, simply because there's less competition. There's less going on in the startup space since everybody is worried about this setback or this recession that's coming up. And if we look at particular lessons from the last big global recessions, some of the best businesses alive today were actually built in 2008. They were built in 2009. They were built in 2007. Crisis always brings around change, but it also brings around opportunity. And those firms, both the startups and the investment firms that resiliently persevere through any incoming financial recession, often are going to come out on top. Something that people forget is that VC has the longest feedback loops from almost any industry out there. Even biotech might give you a result whether a new drug is successful or not after 5 years. But VC funds exist for 10-year windows, right? It's almost half a generation. So a VC fund that's invested 2-3 years ago, we can only really say if that fund has been successful or not in about 2028. So when people say it's the end of the VC world, private equity is going to collapse, I'm afraid to disappoint. It's not that case at all. In fact, you know, we're just starting to see the start of this downturn, but it's not going to get pretty in 23, though it's definitely going to bounce back in the next few years. And people who realize that and build for the future and really focus on what really matters, building businesses who have great revenue streams, who are trending towards profitability, who are building their businesses in a sustainable manner, will ride that wave and will still very much have an opportunity to exit and be an amazing unicorn, billion-dollar firm, or whatever else they see themselves become. As for the decline in Africa, I think it's something that actually is somewhat misreported. So there's a lot of people who report on funding data every year. And actually, from most of the sources that I've seen, the absolute amount of funding in Africa still has grown. In fact, it's the only continent where annual funding year on year has grown as compared to Latin America, Europe, Asia, or North America. The problem is that a lot of people use different classifications. Is a company really African? Is a founder really African? If they're a Nigerian in the diaspora, are they no longer Nigerian? In the contrast, if they're a Chinese guy who comes to Africa and builds a company here, is that company African or not? These questions I can't answer because it's more of a subjective point. But what this means is that different people suggest that different data is incorrect. Though overall, I've found that if we combine the equity financing going towards early stage businesses and the debt financing going towards early stage businesses, 2022 has still been the best year for Africa ever in the tech space. And I imagine that 2023 will still match that. It might not grow, but it will match that. And it will match that because the fundamentals are still there. Has the massive demographic advantage that Africa has over the rest of the world changed? No.
No.
Have countries stopped thinking about interconnectedness? No. Has the African Union suddenly disappeared? No.
No.
In fact, people are becoming much more open to cultural sharing. There's a lot more Nigerians in Ghana, Ghanaians in Nigeria, people traveling all across East Africa and Central Africa. Flights slowly but surely are becoming more accessible. And I can see a future where it's much easier to do business in Africa than it is today. So when all of those fundamentals are still there, and we have a whole new generation of young professionals out there who are now pursuing tech, many of whom are much more entrepreneurial than their peers are in Europe or in the US, I think the future is pretty bright. Don't you?
Absolutely. I mean, great points there, Mark. I think that's really insightful. I mean, the fact that we have, you know, all these pointers, all these fundamentals still strong, I mean, it just makes it very exciting. So all the startup listening out there, you know, just keep building, you know, just keep building, hold up. You get the right investment you need, and you get the right person that believes in your business. So Mark, as we round up, is there any other thing you'd like to share with us?
Yes, I mean, I'd love to share a call to action. I think it's really, really important that especially now when public media, tech media, Twitter is all talking about the negatives of the year to come, individuals realize how much of a contribution each of us can have. When the entire VC space across Africa, all of the employees and funds combined together, are just in the thousands of individuals, sometimes even less than 1,000 people, it's really, really important that more individuals who want to support the startup ecosystem do this. And it's nowhere near as difficult as people think. We even have programs that are dedicated to helping you get there. Our programs with weekly lectures, workshops, assignments, group projects, fireside chats, and direct exposure to the best industry experts who actually invest today focused on Africa are specifically designed to allow an individual with any background before to break into the venture capital space, whether at the junior part of their career, at the mid part of their career, or when they're more senior as a manager, a director, or a company executive. Whoever you are, if you've always had that dream of being an investor, of supporting startups, or wanting to learn more and upskill about it, we'd love to help you get there with that African focus. And our programs will be coming up again in the summer. We will run two programs as usual, our Invest Accelerator and the Launch into VC program. And I'd love to see many of you apply and engage and join our community. And you can find out a lot more about that on the Dream VC website and also in the podcast.
All right. Thank you, Mark. I mean, it's been an exciting conversation. Thank you for being on Curious K podcast. And I want to say thank you too for listening. Curious K as part of the resources to watch out for when having a conversation about startup and VC in Africa. I want to say thank you for that as well, Mark. It's been an exciting conversation, and thank you for being on the show.
Thanks, Kalepo. Please stay curious.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I hope you enjoyed this episode. It's really insightful. And if you did, I mean, feel free to share this with your network, and see you guys next time. Bye-bye.